Hey guys, and welcome to episode 112 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I interviewed Lily Fergus. Now this is the first episode of a new series where I'll be interviewing people with OCD, with no necessarily therapeutic or research-based backgrounds, so people with OCD, because it is called the OCD Stories after all. And you know, what originally helped me was hearing other people's stories. And obviously we do that with a written form on the website, but I also want to now do it on the podcast. So once to maybe twice a month, I'll be interviewing people with OCD to share their story with you. And I'll be asking some similar questions I ask the therapists, but specifically, you know, what's helped them in recovery, what helps them now kind of maintain and not relapse. Words of wisdom, any resources they have that may help you guys. And I hope you enjoy this new feature. I hope it's useful to you. Any one of these features, the start of the episode in the wording, I use the word story, so you clearly know it's a story-based episode and not an expert interview. But there's going to be tons of wisdom shared from, you know, fellow people with OCD. And the first in the series is by Lily Fergus. Now, Lily wrote her story for the OCDstories.com site, which is how I know her, and she kindly agreed to come on the podcast and talk about it, and it was an inspiring chat. We talk about a lot. I think her journey's an inspiring one, a good one. I feel there's a lot to learn from it, so I hope you enjoy it. I hope you learn a lot, and I'll speak to you soon. On the podcast today, I have Lily Fergus, who has kindly agreed to share her OCD story with us. Welcome to the show, Lily.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for coming on to this first in hopefully a long line of OCD stories on the podcast. So it would be good to hear kind of your OCD story in as little as much detail as you want to go into.
Yeah, this is a long story, but I'll try to condense it as much as possible. So my grandfather had OCD as well as my dad. So I kind of know that it was a genetic thing for me.
Yeah.
And I started showing symptoms just really early in life. And then I had a few like traumatic things happen to me per se. I had an uncle pass away from glioblastoma, a really aggressive form of brain cancer. Mm-hmm. And then I had another uncle pass away about a year later, less than a year later, of suicide. And so I started having these really like vivid obsessions about getting brain cancer, a brain tumor, and then these weird like suicidal obsessions, I guess you would say. I know that that's a common theme in OCD, but I thought it meant that I wanted to do something and it scared me to death. And from there, it really just snowballed into something more severe. I started having harm obsessions as well, existential obsessions. It was a spiral, but I finally found the help that I needed and I got better. So that's the condensed version of a very long story.
Okay, no, thank you for that. So I think, I mean, it's interesting what you said about kind of your grandfather had it, because it can be passed down kind of through the generations.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And often, even if it's not OCD, sometimes people may find that their grandmother or father had depression or something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember my dad used to tell me to not drink tap water in America because it's contaminated. And so I developed this like aversion to tap water that other people thought was really odd, but I didn't think it was odd. But that was, now in hindsight, I kind of realized that that was him kind of projecting his own obsessions onto me, which there's nothing wrong with that. He thought he was doing something good for me, but yeah. That's just an example of the parental OCD kind of working into my life.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, I would never say that my mum has OCD, but there's, in hindsight, as you said, looking back, there's definitely things she did around contamination that she said to me that weren't quite normal, so to speak. And contamination's never been a big thing for me, but it is there. And I can see that I have learned that off my mum.
Yeah, I think parents tend to do that to their children with OCD and kind of unintentionally pass on these things that turn into obsessions later, but they're not meaning to. They're just meaning to protect their children.
Absolutely.
And I think that's an interesting thing, kind of the boundary between good parenting and like contributing to OCD.
Yeah, that's very true. And so what age do you feel like it first really sort of came on strong for you, or your earliest sort of memory, I guess?
Well, in hindsight, I see like I remember very vivid memories throughout my life of me having it, but the first time that I really acknowledged that it was a problem was my junior year of high school. I started to have the harm obsessions, and I was like, okay, this is not normal. I am having thoughts about wanting to murder people, and that's not a desire that I actually have. So what the hell is wrong with me? And so I was about 16 or 17 around then, and yeah, that was the start of a long journey.
Yeah, no, thank you. And so you mentioned existential sort of OCD theme. And I guess for the listeners who aren't familiar with that or the word existential, how did that kind of show itself to you?
So in high school, I was really obsessed with philosophy. I took all the possible philosophy or religion related classes. I love kind of abstract ideals. And I think from taking those classes around the time that my OCD became severe, my OCD just kind of attacked those things and attacked the philosophy and religion that I used to love. I used to love these sort of abstract philosophical ideas. And so my OCD just kind of went after it and destroyed that love for me, which I'm trying to get back slowly but surely, but it definitely s steered me away from loving those things.
No, thank you for explaining that. Okay, so I guess focus now on your recovery. I guess good to start with kind of where you're at in that process.
Yeah, so today, I have an interesting therapy journey. I started going to an OCD therapist when I was 18 in September of 2016, and she actually ended her private practice when I was in the middle of therapy. And so I was kind of left without a therapist, kind of looking for one. And my symptoms started to get bad again once I was out of her therapy. But I've ended up finding another therapist. But she did kind of more of a self-directed ERP, which really does not work with me because I'm one of those control freak OCD types. And so I needed the therapist to do it for me and tell me what to do. And I actually had my first appointment with my old therapist who just opened another private practice again because she missed her private practice this morning. So yeah, I'm back with my first therapist. That was great.
Okay, excellent. So where you said sort of self-directed there, you mean so yeah, you need the in your style is you need the therapist to kind of lay out here's each task, and give and set it to you each week, or and it was the other one kind of just saying here's the list, go away and kind of do it. Is that
Yeah, so the self-directed kind of wrapped into my perfectionism and need for control, and I was trying to make the list of exposures perfect and color coordinated, and my therapist wasn't looking at my list. I guess she just kind of trusted me to do my own thing, but she ended up looking at it way later and was like, "This kind of looks like an OCD thing. Maybe we should address that." But yeah, my therapist that I'm back with now and my initial therapist, she kind of runs everything by me. We do an exposure hierarchy and we rate it every 2 weeks. Like, if you were to do this, what would your anxiety level be? And then we revisit it every 2 weeks and she kind of gives me what I should do based on the hierarchy. And I just go do it, which works for me a lot better than the self-directed thing.
Cool. No, thank you for explaining. And how do you find kind of, I guess, holding yourself accountable between sessions to do the homework?
I think it's really just is the desire to get better and that kind of breaking point that you have in OCD where you're like, I cannot live like this anymore. I can't handle this. I will do absolutely whatever it takes to get over this. And that was really kind of what motivated me to really be consistent with my homework, which I saw really good results with. I see really good results with now, so.
Okay, so I guess for anyone starting ERP, what do you wish you would have known at the time when you first started it?
I think with anyone with OCD, when you're wrapped up in compulsions or addiction or anything like that, you want that instant gratification. And with ERP, it really just takes time. And accepting that is very difficult, I think, especially for people with OCD, because you want that instant, oh, I want to feel better immediately. And that's just not how it works. In fact, you're probably going to feel a little bit worse initially until you get better. But that feeling on the other side, and not that you should base your recovery on feelings, but that sense of, oh, wow, I'm so much better, is so worth it to just push through the time that it takes. And it really doesn't take that long of a time in the grand scheme of things, in the grand scheme of your life. But yeah, just hold on.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's very, very effective. So when you first started there, you rightly said that it may even get a bit worse for a short mm-hmm. amount of time, because you're kind of facing that fear and your brain may scream at you. How when you first started, because you obviously now you know that when you do an exposure, although the anxiety is still there, I'm sure you have the confidence that I know that this works and I just have to ride it out. But when you first started, obviously you wouldn't have had that knowledge. So mm-hmm. was it kind of just faith in the therapist, or was it, or did you kind of get a quick win, if that makes sense? Like, what taught you that actually ERP works?
It's really just a combination of faith in yourself and faith in your therapist. And I think I knew that my therapist that I was going to was very successful in her treatments and very well renowned in the community that I'm in for OCD. And so just kind of having that knowledge, as well as just learning, okay, I can trust myself. I can trust myself to handle whatever happens. And that's a hard thing to learn. The trusting the therapist was actually easier initially than trusting myself, but I developed that over time once I got more confidence in the treatment, which didn't take that long. It only took about 2 months to be like, okay, this is working. I just need to keep doing it and be consistent.
Okay. Okay, great. And with the sort of hierarchy, what were the kind of the key themes that I guess you and your therapist targeted first? Was it kind of a medley of everything, or was there one specific theme?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have very like other people related obsessions, like, oh my God, this person's going to hate me. Did I say something wrong? Did I offend this person? Does this person think I'm crazy, etc.? And so my therapist made me, say things in my group message with my friends that would be considered like offensive. And I remember one time one of my friends said something about her boyfriend, and I responded with something, her ex-boyfriend, and I responded with something a little bit snarky, and she actually got upset about it. And I was like, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. Yeah. But I just had to realize, like, okay, I can continue on even if I do get that reaction, because my friend was over it within a matter of a few days, and it wasn't a big deal. So I kind of, that was hard to learn that, oh, these outcomes could actually happen, and learning the uncertainty component of it was a big thing for me in therapy.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That was a really good example. And yeah, you're right, you know, especially in the example you give, people do forget very, very quickly about sort of effectively what are trivial things. But obviously when anxiety is there, it's not trivial, it's very scary. Yes, that was a good learning. And there you mentioned about dealing with uncertainty. Has anything else helped you to learn to just live with, I guess, the open question and not having to justify anything?
That's definitely been one of the hardest things, is kind of accepting that, oh, even if it's a 0.00001% chance of something happening, it still could. And I think just learning to accept that is definitely a process. I'm definitely still working on it. I don't have all of the answers in dealing with uncertainty, but I think it's comforting to know that it's something that literally every human being has ever dealt with and ever will deal with. And it's not something that you have to deal with alone. And it's not something that you will deal with alone. Everyone will. And I think that's a great comfort.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. And you're right to say it's something you will potentially continue to keep doing throughout your life, because it's a natural thing to just now before the call, I was I was getting anxious about something. It wasn't really a big deal, but I was still feeling that rising anxiety in me. And I just had to tell myself or ask myself, can I live with this feeling? Because if I can't, I'm going to go on a downward spiral.
And sometimes,
it's just reminding yourself that.
I think in OCD, it's easy to be like, it's easy to convince yourself that these things won't happen, especially with things like harm and sexual obsessions, because people know that these things aren't desires that we actually have or the content of our character. It's easy to convince yourself that, oh, these things definitely won't happen. And yeah, they most likely won't, but they could.
Yep.
And I think torturing the OCD a little bit with that is actually what makes it better.
Yeah. Yeah, really true. It's kind of learning to sit on the fence and not, as you said, not saying that it's unlikely to happen. And you can actually go the other way, as you just said, and said, actually, no, it may happen. Or it will happen if you want to go really far. Or just live with that open question of kind of, it can go either way and that's okay. I don't need to know. I don't need to find out. I don't need to prove it right or wrong. And okay.
I know a common thing in CBT is looking at the evidence for or against something. And that just never worked for me. That was out the window. Looking at the evidence against something, my brain would always find a way to tell me that it's going to happen. So I think really flipping that on its head and almost like the radical acceptance principle of saying, yes, this will definitely happen is what helped me get better rather than trying to look at evidence and disprove, etc.
Yeah, you're right there. Cognitive restructuring, it's called. I'm not a massive fan for it in the case of OCD, because as soon as you start finding evidence for and against something, you're kind of playing into OCD's game.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, no, a good point. And have you made any kind of lifestyle changes, whether that's, you know, fitness, exercise, diet, nutrition, sleep, lowering stress, meditation, anything like that?
Yeah, not with exercise and food, because I also struggle with BDD, and so kind of making sure that I wasn't making extreme changes in those areas was a part of my recovery. But I did start meditating, and that has been such a game changer. I recommend it to literally everyone, no matter what you're dealing with. If someone's like, oh, I have asthma, meditation. I'm going through a breakup, meditation. I have depression, meditation. I'm like the spokesperson for meditation to people I know in real life.
Okay, now that's really good to hear. And so, because I can agree, you know, in my own life, meditation has had a positive effect. And I know I see a clear difference in my life when I meditate daily compared to when I meditate, say, a few times a month. There's a clear distinction in my overall peace of mind. And obviously a big one for people with OCD is they say, I guess this is for anyone who meditates, but especially with people with OCD and anxiety, they'll say things like, you know, I can't clear my mind, there's too many thoughts going on. Kind of, how would you, I guess, help someone meditate if they're saying things like that to you?
I think that's the point of meditation, is learning to really examine the mind and what it's doing. And meditation is really for people who have an overactive mind. So I would say just continue on with it as hard as it is, even though when your eyes are closed, you're literally looking at your thoughts, you're in your head, and it's terrible at first. Like, I definitely went through that, but I think the benefits definitely outweigh that initial kind of terribleness that it is. So I would just say continue on with it, because meditation is known to help with that sort of thing, to help with an overactive mind. You just have to continue on with it.
Yeah really good. And I also think something to add is, like, just start with 1 minute a day. Because that way, you know, if it is too bad, you've only got to go a minute and not say 10, 20, 30 minutes. And yeah, just focus on the breath and things like that. But no, that's really good. Do you use any apps or anything like that to meditate?
I use the app Calm, which I actually got from you, from one of your emails. And I love Calm. It's my favorite meditation app. I've tried a few, and just like the aesthetic of it, the woman that leads the meditations, her voice is so nice. Her messages are always so nice. I would recommend Calm to anyone who's looking to meditate, for sure.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm glad you read my emails.
I do.
Okay, good. Headspace is good as well for anyone who wants to. I use Calm personally now, but I used to use Headspace because they do a free kind of 10 guided meditations in a row. I actually use just the time meditation now on Calm, with whether it's like the beach sounds or the rain sounds in the background.
Yeah, I have the fireplace sound.
Okay, yeah, that's a good one. Okay, great. And how long have you been doing meditation now?
Since around August 2016. So I guess I'm almost a year and a half into meditation.
Okay, great. And you've obviously loosely touched on this, but what do you think have been the key changes you've noticed because of it?
I think the ability to just kind of say, I am not my thoughts. I am not the content of my thoughts. I don't need to be wrapped up in my thoughts. I don't need to tell myself stories or create narratives around these stupid neurons that are misfiring in my brain. I just can be a whole person that's not just a brain, because I have a kidney, but I'm not a kidney. I have a brain, but I'm not my brain.
Yeah, very good, very good. Yeah, I like that. Okay, so what has been, this may be hard to recall, but if you can, what has been the biggest kind of epiphany for you in your recovery?
Oh, wow. I think it's that uncertainty that I've had bad outcomes from doing exposures, which is kind of the biggest fear in OCD. Like, I don't want these things to happen, but I think learning, Mark Freeman says this a lot, these things may happen, but I can handle it. And I think that's been the biggest epiphany for me, for sure.
Yeah, that's really good. And that kind of links to Stoic philosophy, which is like all the Greek emperors used to do. And that's basically what CBT was built on, was Stoic philosophy. And that's the kind of attitude you just expressed there, which was, even if the worst does happen, I'll handle it. It's that kind of, yeah.
I think training your brain to think that way is one of the most useful things for anyone with a mental illness, or just anyone in life in general, especially with OCD, because we're always thinking about the worst possible thing that could ever happen ever.
Yeah, very true, very true. Okay, so what has been the biggest roadblock in your recovery, and how have you overcome it?
Definitely trying to make my exposures perfect. Trying to be perfect in recovery, trying to make recovery look perfect or be perfect, was a huge roadblock for me, and definitely set me back and was not useful for me at all. And just kind of really challenging that by writing in messy handwriting on my exposures, or not doing them for the full time that I was supposed to, and doing things to kind of challenge that perfectionism within an exposure did help me overcome that.
Okay. Yeah, that's really good. And how did you, is that something you kind of, you came up with, or was that something the therapist spotted and added in?
A little bit of both. Definitely my therapist spotted it and was like, okay, this is an issue, we need to address this. And I just kind of came up with these methods of making exposures not perfect anymore, and not having an expectation on myself of making my recovery perfect. I kind of developed those methods with my therapist as well as on my own.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And that whole kind of not being perfect plays perfectly into the being okay with the unknown and the uncertainty, and yeah, I like
that. For sure, because perfectionism doesn't exist. As much as I would like it to for myself, it doesn't exist.
That is very true. And neither does certainty. Even when we think we're certain, we're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so a quick question on kind of your family. I guess a close question first is, do your family know you have OCD?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And
they do.
Yeah. So next question would be then, how did they find out?
I was very ashamed of some of the intrusive thoughts that I was having. So I really kept it to myself for years because I played out this scenario in my head of, if I tell my parents that I'm having thoughts about murdering people, how am I ever going to explain that away? They're going to report me to the authorities and I'm going to spend the rest of my life in prison. And I ended up telling my dad, and he has OCD. He never had harm stuff, but that I knew of, but he ended up telling me that he had the same thoughts and that the best way to overcome intrusive thoughts was just to let them be. And that was kind of a turning point. And then, my mom found out a little bit after that. And it took a while from there for me to finally go to therapy, which was more of just an ignorance / lack of education on my part. I didn't know that ERP existed. I didn't know that there were therapies for OCD or that it could become as severe as it did. And so really having it get to a severe point and really getting to that breaking point is what finally got me into therapy.
Okay. No, thank you for explaining. And so going back to the conversation with your dad, how did you kind of, or how, I guess, it was, how hard was it and how did you open up to him?
Yeah, I remember I was driving and I just had these really intrusive thoughts, really vivid intrusive thoughts about like pulling my car over and harming myself or accidentally hitting someone else. And I just had this full-blown anxiety attack. And I had to call my parents and I was like, please come pick me up. And they were like, what happened? What happened? What happened? And I told my dad, I'm having these thoughts about hurting myself or other people, but I don't want to do that. I promise. Like, it's causing me so much anxiety. I don't know what to do. And, I ended up telling him, I think I have OCD because I had done a little bit of research about it. I remember Googling, I have thoughts about wanting to murder people, but I don't actually want to. And OCD came up. And so I expressed to him that I think I have OCD. And he was like, well, yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Thank you for explaining that. And
I really just got to a breaking point with that thought where I was like, I have to tell someone. I can't live like this anymore.
Yeah, that's really good. And I think, yeah, it's good that people get to that point. But it's almost sad that we as a community can't open up sooner. You know what I mean? It's sad that we have to get to breaking point before we speak up. And I guess a lot of that is to do with stigma and just lack of information and knowledge, and hopefully that changes and people in the future won't have to get to the breaking points.
Definitely. I've had two people contact me recently because I'm pretty open with my OCD and the specifics of it on social media, which I've actually been criticized for by my peers, which is frustrating. But I've had two people message me saying, oh my God, I have these thoughts too. Like, you've put a name to it. You've helped me so much. Like, I'm going to finally go get help now, which was very like rewarding for me.
Absolutely. And when you said your peers, is that peers kind of within the OCD community or peers like college or work or?
No. So I guess I don't know if I'm considered a millennial or Gen Z. I really don't know. But us young folk have these things called Finstas, which is code for fake Instagram, which is just like your close friends that follow you. And I remember I was having just like a really bad night with my OCD pretty recently, and I posted this thing and I talked about the specific of my obsessions about having thoughts about harming people and offending people and getting diseases, etc. And someone called me and said that people were like saying bad things about me. And I was like, wait, what? Like, I definitely explained in the post that these things were normal for OCD, but I think that just comes along with the stigma of OCD and the stigma of thoughts, that people genuinely think if you have a thought, it means something about you, which I think is what people thought I was saying, which was anxiety provoking for me because I was like, I don't want people to think that I actually think these things. And it's a very difficult place to be in OCD.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not to reassure you, but I will. I think, yeah, it's up to if it was aligned with your values to share your story and be open about OCD, then you absolutely did the right thing. And like you said, those people came to you and said, well, you know, you've helped me put a name to it. I'm now going to get treatment. And, you know, that's all that matters. Sadly, no matter how, I mean, the best intentioned people in the world get pulled down. You look at anyone in history that's done anything great and wonderful, they had millions of haters. You know, I'm not a religious person, but Jesus was teared down. Martin Luther King was destroyed by many people, but we now know he was doing very noble things for the world. Aristotle had a quote, Greek philosopher, and he said, if you want to avoid criticism, say nothing, do nothing, and be nothing. And I think what he meant by that was just, you're going to get criticized no matter what you do on this earth. So as long as you're living by your values, that's all that matters.
Exactly. And that was something that I had to kind of reevaluate with myself, that, okay, yeah, these people are talking about me. They may say terrible things about me, but that has nothing to do with me. I clearly explained what these things are about and what they mean. And I also included in my post, like, go research OCD if you don't believe what I'm saying, because I can't convince you. You can easily go on Google and type in harm OCD or fears of murdering people OCD, and you will get a million results. And that's not for something I did wrong. Like, those people are just judging me for, I guess, lack of knowledge, which I don't blame them for, because OCD is heavily stigmatized. But
yes,
I'm working on changing that.
Absolutely, and good for you. I think it was a good thing. There are many keyboard warriors out there who pull people down but won't do anything to change the world. So you're on the right side of history.
Okay. Thank you.
No worries. So where's my next question? Okay, so what would you tell someone who's just starting their recovery journey?
Oh, wow. Get support. There's a vast OCD community online. Definitely look into your podcast, look into Mark Freeman, look into acceptance and commitment therapy, start meditating, get in a routine, and really just have faith in the process, because it works. There's like an 85% recovery success rate in OCD. So you're not fighting against impossible odds, which is something that I have to remind myself often. These things work, and just have faith in the process. And that other 15% where it doesn't work, people are usually tying in perfectionism and not being consistent and ending therapy too early. So just make sure that all the factors for success are lined up.
Well, yeah, that's a very good message. And that bit about the 15%, I agree. I asked Jonathan, Dr. John.
I Googled him the other day, so I know who you're talking about.
He's one of the world-leading experts in OCD research. It was an honor to have him on the show. And I asked him, you know, with ERP being so effective, is there such a thing as treatment-resistant OCD? And he basically said, no, there isn't. He said, usually if ERP is not working, it's because the therapist isn't doing something right, or they haven't tailored it enough to the client, the client's not putting in the effort, or there's a million and one reasons. But the point is, there's always a way to get it to work. And absolutely, like you said, there could be other things that they're not tackling, like perfectionism. There could be another comorbid disorder. Maybe there's depression that isn't being treated first, or whatever it is. And it's just figuring out. And also bolting on things to support the ERP, like you just said about ACT. Maybe it's meditation, maybe it's running. Because recovery is also about improving life generally, not just recovery from OCD.
Yeah, for sure. I think another big barrier, and this was a barrier for me too, was just the overwhelming anxiety, especially when you're starting out, because you're already going into therapy anxious and you want to get over the anxiety. But the ERP is only provoking the anxiety. And you're like, what's the disconnect here? But really, that means it's working. So I think overcoming the really terrible panic attack type of anxiety that kind of comes at the breaking point when you're like, okay, now I have to get treatment, is really necessary to being successful in ERP, because that is going to be a huge barrier, and it definitely was for me.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. And a moment ago, you mentioned ACT, so acceptance and commitment therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, how has ACT helped you in this process?
Definitely with the sayings, I'm having a feeling of blank, or I'm having a thought that blank, and kind of taking yourself out of the equation and just saying, okay, this is what's happening. I accept it. I move forward, and I can do something that I care about, rather than sitting at home anxious about the thoughts that are going in my head or the anxiety that I'm feeling. I can just go forward anyways, which is so much easier said than done.
Yeah, absolutely. I found with ACT, it's very much, as with everything, but especially with ACT, it's very much a skill set, like learning a new skill, whether it's a sport or whatever it is. Like you said, learning to be able to catch your thoughts and kind of say, I'm having a thought and not I am this thought, which is the
exactly.
big distinction. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's definitely something that people with OCD think that they are their thoughts, and that kind of society as well pushes, which I've seen in my real life with the post that I had, that, oh, you have a thought, that means something about you. And so it's really hard to fight that instinct, and as well as what kind of society in the world has taught us about thoughts.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think from a societal point of view, definitely in the UK, and I'm sure in the States, you just don't get taught the distinction of what thoughts actually are and mm-hmm. if they're actually true or not, which we know
exactly.
it's just vomit effectively in the mind.
And in the US right now, we just had a mass shooting
yes.
less than a week ago, and there's a really big conversation from very misinformed people about mental health and pushing this narrative that this man was mentally ill, and that's the real issue, but that's a whole different podcast. But anyways, there's a really destructive conversation going on about mental health that's very frustrating and damaging for a lot of people, because a majority of mental illness sufferers are not dangerous, and many countries in the world have people struggling with their mental health, but not everyone has children being shot in their schools.
yeah, absolutely. And I think the whole, this is me maybe being a conspiracy theorist, the whole media attention around mental illness being the problem behind these mass shootings is just a way to defer from gun policy.
Oh, it definitely is. 100%.
And I'm not against people having guns, because I know 50% of Americans are, and I have a big American audience. But
yeah,
I think there needs to be restrictions. Assault rifles, come on. That can't,
yeah, yeah, no one needs a military grade weapon, but no. That's a different podcast. But on the mental health realm,
yeah.
I mean, just this narrative being pushed that everyone with a mental illness is dangerous, and this man that committed the shooting must have been mentally ill, and it was documented that he was. And yes, people with mental illnesses can be dangerous, but not, you can't paint us all with one brush.
No.
And especially people with OCD are not going to be dangerous 99 times out of 100 times.
Absolutely. And there's a stat, I'm not sure what the study was based on, but it's, as far as I'm aware, a pretty reputable source. And basically the stat was, if you have a mental illness, you're more likely to be on the receiving end of violence than you are to be the one giving it. So
yeah.
That stat kind of shows that if you don't have a mental illness, you're more violent and dangerous to society.
I also read a stat that people with mental illnesses and people without are no less likely to be violent. I mean, the proportions of violence among both groups are basically the same.
Absolutely, I agree.
I think with mental illnesses like psychopathy and sociopathy and pedophilia, etc., those obviously are going to be more dangerous individuals.
Yeah.
But general anxiety, depression, the more, I guess, mainstream, more common mental illnesses, not that more severe ones aren't more common, but you know what I mean, are most likely not going to be dangerous at all. They're probably more afraid of what's going on in their head and being a danger to themselves than other people.
Well, absolutely. And this is what Stephen Phillipson said when I interviewed him. And he offers people with sort of paedophile-based obsessions. He offers, you know, they can babysit his kids, although they're old now, but when they were younger. Because he knows they're safer with those people having those worries than the general public who aren't.
Exactly.
No, it's a good point, and it's
that's a very good illustration of OCD, that you can put someone with OCD who has harm obsessions or pedophilia obsessions in a room with a gun and a person or small children, and no one's worried about them.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, the whole debate around mental illness in the media, like, I don't watch the news. I'm unapologetic about that, because I often say I'd rather be uninformed than ill-informed, just because the news gets the messages wrong on many topics. And mental health is a big one that gets wrong. So,
for sure.
Yeah, I like to keep my stress levels low, which means I don't like to get into the debate with...
I'm a big political junkie, which is just bad for having OCD.
Yeah.
But... I try to be an educated consumer and consume things from people that I disagree with and agree with, and try to check my sources, etc.
Yeah, that's good. That's absolutely the approach to take. I think I'm just too lazy to do it, so I detach completely. Do you have a favorite book or resource you want to recommend?
I would recommend Mark Freeman's YouTube channel to start out with, for sure.
Absolutely.
Because you don't have to buy anything. You don't have to read anything. If you don't like to read, you can just use your computer and search it on YouTube and you're good to go. You'll find a lot of helpful information.
Yeah, his videos are really good, and he has a friendly style, which is easy to listen to.
Yep. Absolutely. And he uses a lot of metaphor, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I agree. The storytelling is a nice approach.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. So coming towards the end of the interview now, and I have a few questions. So you've probably heard these before, but you're in an elevator going up, a few stories with someone with OCD. They've heard you on this podcast and they ask you for a little advice. What do you say to them?
I would say trust the process. I'm a very big believer in... like positive psychology to an extent. And I would also tell them, as woo-woo as this sounds, and there are exceptions to this, try to reframe or restructure your brain to think positively, because that was a tremendous help for me. But don't replace your negative thoughts with positive ones or anything like that. Accept the positive thoughts. But when you have a moment where you're not thinking anything, just think a positive thought, and that will help.
Yeah, really, really good advice. And I agree, it can sound woo-woo, but there's more and more evidence being published to back up positive psychology. And I think it's such a powerful addition to things like ERP and just for everyone in life.
Definitely.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, as you said, about thinking a positive thought when your mind's kind of blank is a good way to look at it.
Definitely. Don't try to... replace obsessions with positive thoughts, or think a positive thought in the midst of negativity. Just try to accept those things, and then when you're kind of at equilibrium and you're in control of what your mind is thinking, just throw in a positive thought and it'll make a difference over time.
Absolutely. And I think that's it. Also, it comes back to kind of gratitude. Just, you know, even if it's like, oh, I'm grateful the sky is blue today, after 10 days of doing that, you probably will notice a shift.
Yes, for sure.
Maybe not in OCD, but you'll notice a shift in just general mental well-being.
For sure. I'm a big believer in writing things down. And so I have a gratitude journal, and I write three things down that I'm grateful for every day, and it's made a huge difference. And I also have a Google Doc where each month I write the date, and under it, it's just a bunch of bullet points. It's basically a brain dump where I write every single thing down. And don't make that into a compulsion, obviously, but anything can become a compulsion. But definitely in OCD, Keep a journal that's for kind of motivating you and inspiring you, and not a compulsive way to like disprove your thoughts or anything like that.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And it's great to hear that you keep a track and write it down. I don't write it down just because I'm lazy in the mornings, but it is a very good practice for those that can find the time. Okay, great. So you've got a billboard wherever you are in the States. What do you want written on that billboard for the world to see?
You are not your thoughts. Or no. I would have my quote that I said earlier. You have a kidney, but you are not a kidney. You have a brain, but you are not your brain. And then something under it about mental health.
Yeah. Okay, excellent. No, I love
to
it.
To put it in context.
Yeah, true. Okay, so last question. For those that want to live a good life, a fulfilled life, an amazing life, whatever word we want to use there, what advice do you have?
For an OCD sufferer, I would say go through with treatment and build on a healthy life, build from wherever you're at. And this is just actually for anyone in general. Start from where you are and build from there. Don't try to take things away or replace things with other unhealthy things that are just kind of neutralizing the pain and making it tolerable. That's a Mark Freeman quote, loosely paraphrased, but build from where you are and build on it, build from where you are healthily.
Yeah, I like that. And is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you wish you could say?
I wrote some things down. Give me one second.
No worries.
I wrote down in recovery, be a sponge in recovery. When my symptoms started to get better, I started to have this thought like, I'm good. I'm good for the rest of my life. I don't have to learn anything else. This is it. And that's kind of a harmful thing to have in OCD and just as a human in general, because there's always more things to learn. So I would say that just also general life advice for people with OCD, be a sponge in recovery and keep learning. Don't stop learning in recovery. It's a never-ending process. It's not a destination. It's kind of a never-ending road.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I really like that. I think that's an important message that I think we all realize at some point. So hopefully people hearing this will realize it sooner and won't have to go through what we did to learn that.
Yes. Don't go through what I went through to learn that. Just take it in right now.
There you go. Heed the advice, I should say. Okay. So thank you for coming on, Lily. I really enjoyed talking with you and I appreciate you opening up and spreading the word that people with mental illness aren't all criminally insane.
Yes, I think that's very important. And I try to be open with everyone about OCD and mental illness, which I get criticism for, but that's fine. I can handle it.
Absolutely. And, you know, respect to you for doing it.
Thank you.
But yeah, stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed talking to you about all the OCD things.
So thanks again to Lily for coming on. And quick disclaimer, this podcast is not a replacement for therapy. It's not therapy either. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. Have a good week and I will speak to you soon.